at 1.5 degrees of heating globally. Now, this is globally. Australia itself has already heated 1.4. You've got to remember, where I was living in Ningxia, it's already heated 2.6 degrees. The Arctic's heated over 4 degrees. So we're talking about averages here. But at 1.5, we're going to lose, between 70 and 90% of the coral reefs. We're talking Ningaloo here. So it doesn't take a lot to join the dots. At 2 degrees, we're going to lose 99% of coral reefs.
So today's topic is activism, and it's a topic that can be very polarizing. However, activism, whether you like it or not, is hugely responsible for how life is for all of us today. Looking into it, unbelievably, it wasn't until 1980 that there were legal consequences for driving whilst intoxicated in the US. And this all came down to Candy Leiter, who founded Mothers Against Drunk Driving after her 13-year-old daughter was killed by a repeat drunk driver.
Indeed, I think it's in 1992 that the Australian government recognised the land rights of the Indigenous Australians, and that was through protest and activism. As well, in 1928, the British women gained a legal right to vote. And as well, that was done through protest and activism.
Absolutely. And sometimes it takes that for the government to understand that that's the change that the people want. If people hadn't have done this, there wouldn't have been the suffragette movement. The women wouldn't have had the right to vote. Martin Luther King wouldn't have got the civil rights movement through. There's a whole number of things if you look at our history.
And as we are watching the news today, there's people going out on the streets all over the world fighting for women's rights and for their rights against violence. And as well, I think there are people out in the UK fighting for the right to protest.
Yeah, that seems to be a very scary turn of events lately, where governments are looking at ways to stop any protest. And if we look back in history, if that would have been done earlier, our world just would not be the same.
We've been looking forward to interviewing one of the Extinction Rebellion members, especially as they're ramping up with events all over the world, and especially here in Australia. On the 22nd of March, we have a big protest called Rebel for Life. Hope you can make it. We will definitely be there. If you have a little bit of rebel in you, come out and protest with us.
So with that in mind, today we are talking to Heath Greville, who is a rebellious grandma and a great, caring, loving lady who's part of Extinction Rebellion. Hello and welcome to the How to Be Good podcast. I'm here with Heath Greville from Extinction Rebellion. How are you?
Hi there. Great to be here.
Good, good. So before we get into lots of details about Extinction Rebellion and what they do, what we'd really love to know is more about you and how you got involved first.
To tell you, I'm 67, so I'm a baby boomer. I work as a public health researcher at the University of WA, and I've never really been an activist before. I've kind of been peripherally involved. But after the last election, I, like many other people, felt really low about government action on climate change. I did join the Greens, but then 2 weeks later, I found that there was an Extinction Rebellion meeting very close to me. And I went to that and I discovered that the values and principles of this organisation were just so resonant with lots of things that I'd been looking for in a social movement. It got me. And the commitment to creativity and non-violence and peaceful engagement, diversity, so many things about the movement were attractive that, I was hook, line and sinker.
Fantastic. So what was your original sort of career type background?
Oh, okay. Well, I spent the first 10 years of my working life traveling and doing all kinds of odd jobs, which was a fantastic background. I went back to uni and did a degree in Chinese and communications. Then I lived in China for a couple of years. And then I had my son and decided I'd do a teaching degree. That led to work as an adult educator in the Centre for Aboriginal Studies at Curtin University, and I was there for a lot of the 1990s. Learned a huge amount there about putting an Indigenous lens on things and also about grassroots movement and community development. And then for the 2000s, I was working in public health and mostly in the area of Aboriginal health, mostly in the area of sexual health, actually, which is a great background to understanding how government policy can work well or not well around people's personal lives, mm-hmm. I guess you could say, and the importance of education and bringing people along with you and all those kinds of things. So then I went back to China in 2014 and started setting up a little charity that worked in remote primary schools, teaching music and English to give rural kids a better educational opportunities to get into high school. And I was living in a part of the country there called Ningxia, which not many people have heard of. It's a very deserty region. There are very few trees. The people there were living a very marginal kind of lifestyle, very small-scale sheep herders growing a little bit of corn. Some of them, actually many of them, millions of them, in fact, live in caves. And it sounds very primitive, but in fact they are beautiful caves lined with, you know, lovely ceramic tiles and with electricity and things. But those people's livelihoods was devastated by a huge drought in China in 2006. So right where I was living was an area where some of the world's first relocated people due to climate change, recognised due to climate change, was actually happening. So about 500,000 people had been moved off these marginal lands. They could choose not to, they could choose to stay, but the government had withdrawn government services like schools and clinics from those areas, so there was a little bit of pressure for them to move to these constructed villages where their livelihoods were actually safer and the kids weren't going to suffer from malnutrition and they weren't going to run out of water. So yeah, that was the first time I thought, oh wow, this is actually happening right here in front of me.
It's a lot of the time I find people look at climate change as something that's going to happen in the future, whereas actually we're in it. It's happening. It's been happening for quite some time.
Exactly. And it's only when you suddenly think, okay, you know, 500,000 people, and that was only one section of this policy, 500,000 people have not had enough to eat and enough water here. And of course, yeah, this is going on. That was a one-party state, so you could make those changes and move those people. But of course, for many, many people for whom this is happening now, they don't have the advantage of a government that is actually going to take control and build another village for them. They're going to be abandoned. Yeah.
Hence the large migration numbers from Africa to European countries and so on. They're all fleeing.
Absolutely.
Dry lands with no food.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people say that the Syrian civil war was one of the drivers of it, was in fact climate change and the loss of livelihoods for exactly these reasons.
So many of our listeners have heard about Extinction Rebellion, but it would be great if you could tell us more about it and the goals that as an organization you're trying to achieve.
We have three goals. The first one is for the government and the media to tell the truth about the extent of the crisis that we're facing. I think since the movement was started in 2018, in fact, we are hearing a lot more of the truth now. Certainly from certain aspects of the media. But the extent of devastation, I don't think, is people haven't joined the dots and realised what it's going to actually mean for them. That's our first goal, tell the truth. Our second goal is act now, act as if the truth is real. So don't say, yeah, it's going to be awful, but hell, you know, 2050 is good enough, 2060 is good enough, the next election cycle is good enough. We're saying act now and reduce emissions to zero by 2025, which we know is impossible. But we say we actually aspire to the necessary, not the possible, because that's what's necessary. Our third goal is we call it beyond politics, but it's actually beyond party politics. It's about giving decision-making power to groups of people through citizens' assemblies, which are a tried-and-true method of getting citizens to actually make complex decisions in situations where party politics just aren't working. And there are lots of good examples of that from around the world already. It's happened. So those are our three aims. And we have 10 values and principles about diversity and being non-hierarchical, sharing power, valuing everybody and every part of everybody, non-violence, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. What action have you directly been involved in within the local Western Australia group?
Well, I was involved with a big action which was called Flood the City in 2019. That was a great action where we took an intersection in Perth and 72 people got arrested during that action. And the purpose of that was to disrupt. So our sort of tactic is to disrupt business as usual, because we say business as usual is the problem. You know, we can't continue to just operate as though this emergency isn't happening. We have to change course really rapidly. So we disrupt business as usual by blocking major thoroughfares. We always let the police know that we're going to do that so that the ambulances know which way to go and the fire engines which way to go. This is part of our non-violent principles. So I was involved in Flood the City, and I was involved then in some smaller actions. Merry Crisis was a great one at Christmas time, where we also actually blocked the same intersection with Madame Claus and a few elves and some blocks of ice and a few Christmas crisis carols. And I was involved in the Festival of Love and Rage, where we sort of looked at the bridge across the freeway between Parliament House and the top of St George's Terrace as a site. It's sort of representing the link between the WA government and the fossil fuel industries, which is actually a very toxic and corrupt link. So we sort of marched along that road and held that bridge for a very short time and did some creative things on that bridge. And you know, I was arrested at Love and Rage, and I was arrested at Flood the City.
One of the core activities is nonviolent action and civil disobedience. Can you tell us why this approach is taken?
Sure. Well, the science actually of social movements shows that nonviolent direct action is more effective. It's about 50% more effective in terms of really achieving the government change that you want. When you're nonviolent, you make an action that anybody can join. So, you know, we have very young children coming to our actions. We have people in wheelchairs coming to our actions. We have people of all ages and all walks of life coming because they know it's going to be peaceful and it's going to be nonviolent and they can join in. So there are tactical reasons for being nonviolent, but there are also reasons of principle, because we want to be the change we want to see, if you like. So nonviolence works very much at that level too, about we want to create a just society that doesn't exploit the natural world and that doesn't exploit other people. In terms of civil disobedience, we take civil disobedience because, yeah, like I say, it's worked. It worked for, in my lifetime, it's worked for the civil rights movement in the United States. It's worked for a very strongly shifted government opinion on the Vietnam War when I was a teenager. It worked to save the Franklin Dam. Before my lifetime, civil disobedience worked to get Australia an 8-hour day. People don't realise we were the first nation on the planet to achieve an 8-hour day. And we got that by people going on strike, by breaking the law, by being naughty, if you like, and by standing up for what's right. So we use tactics of civil disobedience really because the means available to us as citizens of this country, that is like voting and signing petitions and going to see our politician and so on and so forth, writing letters to the paper, they're not working. They're not working, and they're not working fast enough. So that's why we use non-violent civil disobedience.
What happened when you got arrested?
I'm glad you asked me that because, you know, the law is rightly a very scary thing for people, and many people are terribly afraid of breaking the law, and that's how we've been raised as citizens. I suppose our approach is the government isn't really looking after us anymore, so we are willing to break the law to show how desperate and how important this issue is. So what happened is the police, both times I've been arrested, have been incredibly respectful. They are actually very, very great human beings, and they take you to the lockup and they get all your details and they take your DNA and they take your fingerprints and your photograph, and they do a lot of paperwork, which seems very laborious and takes ages, and I'm sure their systems could be a lot better than they are. I think they actually write everything out by hand in triplicate. And then eventually you're released, and then our movement is committed to having people outside to give you a big hug and a cheer and something to eat and make sure that you've got some way of getting home safely. So that's, you know, it's good to go through that process to understand it's not the huge wall of fear and unknown that you think it is.
Yeah, there's always lots and lots of images put up on media, you know, through the TV and so forth, and probably most especially through the Murdoch side of the media, to make it look like it's a horrendous thing, that you could potentially be being bashed by police and all this kind of stuff. When in actual fact, a lot of what we're hearing is that there's a reasonable amount of sympathy for what you guys are trying to achieve from those having to police it.
I'm not going to dob anybody in here, but we've had police say to us, we really support what you're doing, and we love the music. They like our actions. You know, I should add, though, of course, our nice middle-class people experience of the law is not everybody's experience of the law. And
true.
We're very fortunate that we are treated that way as protesters. I mean, the police don't really want to have to deal with us. You know, they'd probably rather be out chasing criminals than, you know, grandparents who are having a tea party in St. George's Terrace. So, yeah, but, you know, the law is not like that for everybody, and the experience of being in the lockup is not like that for everybody, and we certainly acknowledge that, yeah.
So there's often some quite polarizing views of Extinction Rebellion. How do you deal with those?
Well, you know, we understand people don't like having their daily lives disrupted. And we understand that people think we should use the non-disruptive methods that I just talked to you about, you know, sending petitions and walking along the footpath and having peaceful marches. And the thing is, like I've said, those methods haven't worked. So when people get annoyed, we say sorry. Sometimes we have pamphlets that say sorry. But we say this emergency is so important that disruption is the only means to really get the system-wide action on the scale we need. And the disruption that you're experiencing today, not being able to get to your meeting or your conference or whatever, your job, is nothing compared with the disruption of your kids and your grandkids are going to have looking for sources of food and water, you know, and experiencing social breakdown. So, you know, I didn't join this movement to make friends, really. You know, I know I'm going to annoy people, and that's the tactic. And it's hard because we all want to be liked. You know, we want everybody to like us, but not everybody is ever going to.
Yeah, I completely understandable. I mean, during the actual events, and we've spoken very briefly about some of the policemen and women actually agreeing with your action, but On the whole, how has the public reaction and those policing events been?
On the whole, they've been pretty positive. We did a little disruption yesterday at Sculpture by the Sea down in the beach where we put our heads in the sand, and we did disrupt somebody who didn't want to be anywhere near us. But everybody else was standing around really enjoying it and very interested in taking pamphlets. So, you know, one of the things we do try and have in our actions is a great vibe. You know, we have good music, we have dance music, we have colour, we have flags, we have diversity. And, you know, I'd say mostly the reaction is very positive. The thing that is a little bit annoying is people say, we are so great what you're doing, so great what you're doing. But, of course, our tactics only work if thousands of us do it. And so I want to say to people, yeah, but come and join us. You can do this too. It's not that hard. You know, there's a very proud history of civil disobedience in Australia. I think we've become terribly afraid of being visible, of taking bold steps, of just being a bit bolshy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a difference in the level of interest in activism between Australia and other countries?
I think there probably are cultural differences. But I probably can't really comment on other countries. What I have noticed is I think the Australian public is far more ignorant about climate change, certainly than the Europeans are. And friends who've lived in Europe and lived here say that, you know, we get people sort of just laughing at us, well, that's okay, but or saying things like, you know, you're being ridiculous, whereas I think the public reaction in other places is more, okay, we understand why you're doing this. We understand the severity of the crisis that we're facing. I'm not sure about differences in the acceptability of civil disobedience in different places, but certainly there are differences in the awareness of the climate crisis.
Despite the evidence for many warnings from Extinction Rebellion, why do you think the government is continuously ignoring?
I don't think we're big enough yet to make a real difference. But I think every time a decision maker sees it, I think they think, yeah, they're right. What can I do? Well, it's like our third demand, move beyond politics. That governments are really only thinking to the end of the next election cycle. And we just hear this terrible mantra, it's going to cost jobs, it's going to cost jobs. And what they really mean is it's going to cost votes, it's going to cost votes. And, you know, we as a movement certainly acknowledge jobs are really important. Everybody deserves a livelihood. We live in a very unequal society. You know, the one we create to combat climate change has to be more equitable, and we can't afford to leave people behind. So we talk about a just transition, and we talk about let's bring the jobs with us when we create new forms of energy. And the WA government is totally in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry, and so is the federal government. You know, the links have been shown. Greenpeace did that great little video about the advisors at the federal level are in and out of the Minerals Council and in and out of fossil fuel industries. You know, we are captive. We are a captive state to the fossil fuel industry.
I think the only way that this is likely to change in terms of local government or state government is that if they realise that there's enough people that aren't willing to accept their pockets being lined by the fossil fuel lobby and their campaigns being lined, funded by the fossil fuel lobby, and that they actually want full and climate action, and that's the only way they're actually going to get a vote and therefore keep their job. I think that's the only way we're going to see real change at that level that's the only way I can see it at the moment. We just need to get more people involved to make them realise that.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Are you seeing any companies being inspired by your activism to change, companies or large businesses?
It's amazing what's happening in some places. Our biggest success was in London 2019 when, you know, within days of the big action that shut down London, the UK declared a climate emergency, and that was the first government to do so. Now, there's lots of critique and saying, yes, they declared it, but they haven't acted on it enough. But in fact, the UK are doing some amazing things. So in terms of big businesses, the National Health Service in the UK is the biggest employer in the UK. In fact, it's the fifth biggest employer in the world. It's got 1.5 million employees. And they are doing amazing things on their carbon emissions at that level, and have been doing for decades. Pressure had come from within. Like, there are so many health groups that are activists in the climate change area. It's amazing. So, the UK government, the National Health Service, IKEA are going to be carbon neutral by 2030. Microsoft are going to be carbon neutral by 2030. Lots of banks, superannuation organisations, yeah, they're paying close attention to the different kinds of activism that either their investors or people like us are doing. It's the level at government that we're not seeing enough action on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we can do lots of, I guess, voting with our preferences and our wallets, so that, you mentioned super funds, we could make sure that we only use ethical super funds. Banking, we could only use ethical banking, and so forth. So there's lots of things that people can do, but I think there's not an awful lot of, or there hasn't been until it's changing recently, an awful lot of information for people to understand what they can do and how they can do it.
That's right. And I'll probably add why they can do it. Although there is, I think, what was it? The ABC did a poll. 84% of people want more action on climate change. In the UK, it's over 90. The massive amount of people do want to do things. And the thing is, my super fund, I'm locked into an industry super fund. And so you've actually got to become an activist to get them to change. And, really be very, very, move your money around and do those kind of the small things that individuals can do.
Absolutely. So here in Australia, we're going to be and have already started to be hugely affected by climate change. And I know that you've followed with interest the WA government's climate health report, which presents compelling data for why urgent action is required to prevent disaster. Can you tell us a bit more about the report?
Yeah, well, it followed a climate health inquiry, and they got a lot of great submissions. I mean, the process was very good, and the aim of it was to make recommendations for improvement with respect to climate change mitigation and public health adaptation strategies. So, I suppose the second chapter of it is a really good summary of the big report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which came out in 2018, about mm-hmm. the importance of keeping the temperature under 1.5. So that's the global amount of heating since the industrial age, under 1.5.
Yeah.
And they do a great summary of that, and they talk about the difference between 1.5 and 2 for Western Australia. Lots of really good detail about climate change, and nicely summarised, nice infographics. It's really great. But then they stop at saying, and actually they say something like, global CO2 emissions need to be reduced well before 2030, because otherwise, there'll be more drastic action will be needed later. They say these things, and to avoid extreme temperatures, to avoid all the health impacts that are very well articulated in that health report for West Australians, lots of them, terrible things, heat waves, drought, mosquito-borne diseases, food insecurity, water insecurity, displacement of populations, on and on and on. But, it's a very good report. And they say, we've got to keep emissions down below 2030. But, of course, they weren't empowered to say, so therefore we should stop investing in liquid natural gas. We should stop extracting fossil fuels. They stop there. But I do recommend that report, the Climate Health Report, for West Australians, definitely to read.
There's no commitment for them to do anything by 2030 or by 2025. So,
No, the commitments aren't there. That's the terrible thing.
So from that report, did it go into what WA would look like then with a 2-degree rise? What impacts are likely to happen?
I don't actually know that you would see that level. It says things like at 1.5 degrees of heating globally. Now, this is globally. Australia itself has already heated 1.4. You've got to remember, where I was living in Ningxia, it's already heated 2.6 degrees. The Arctic's heated over 4 degrees. So we're talking about averages here. But at 1.5, we're going to lose, what is it, between 70 and 90% of the coral reefs. We're talking Ningaloo here. So it doesn't take a lot to join the dots. At 2 degrees, we're going to lose 99% of coral reefs. They talk about the difference in risk. So between 1.5 and 2 degrees, it's, you know, 10 times more drastic in terms of the impact on human populations. So they don't drill it right down to what that means actually in terms of sea level rise in Perth, for example. But in fact, what it means is something like the difference between, you know, a metre of sea level rise versus 3 metres of sea level rise.
Yeah, absolutely. So why do you think the government have their head in the sand? And don't get me wrong, I think I know what your answer is going to be on this, but I would perhaps like to hear it from you. So why do you think the government have their head in the sand about these issues?
You know, sometimes, and I'm sure the listeners and you yourselves are aware, you can start to feel quite like you're going crazy because the science is so evident. You know, like there is no doubt now that we're facing, you know, mass starvation, mass displacement of millions, billions of people. Anybody with a science background will tell you that. And yet we have this government that is giving out more licenses to drill liquid natural gas. And, you know, it's touted as a clean energy. It's actually filthy. You know, it produces methane, the extraction of it, the refining of it. This is before it's even left Australia to be burnt. It's a filthy fossil fuel. So I think they've got their heads in the sand because they're not joining the dots. Okay, if that the climate crisis is this bad, we have got to stop extracting fossil fuels. We've got to stop burning them. We've got to stop using coal. I think they've got their heads in the sand about that. And I think they've got their heads in the sand, as we said before, about the links between the fossil fuel industry and, yeah, gifts to politicians and gifts, you know, yeah. It's the money. It's the money. And I think they've got their heads in the sand about short-termism and it's all about the next election. And they think that we're fools, you know, that we don't think about our children and our grandchildren and the generations ahead. You know, lots of us think further than the next election cycle. We're so exasperated with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just as a little fact about methane that I read just the other day, actually, methane in its first two decades is 85% more potent than CO2. And this is touted and labeled as natural gas as if it's a clean option, which it just blatantly isn't.
Yeah, no, I call it CO2 on steroids. Yeah, it traps heat. It traps heat. Yeah, like you say, nearly 90 times more effectively than CO2 does. It breaks down faster, but those 2 decades, which are the 2 decades we're looking at, the critical 2 decades.
Yeah.
This government's busy getting up close and personal and having a love affair with this terrible, terrible pollutant.
It's very, very disheartening. So let's try to change the tone a little bit before we all get really, really depressed on this. What global wins has Extinction Rebellion had, I guess, more recently or since its inception? Now, give us that optimism. Obviously, you mentioned the 2019 one in the UK.
Yeah, that was a really big one, and that gave a lot of hope. Since then, in the UK, they've also achieved a citizens' assembly on climate change, which is great. I think, you know, globally, what's happened is I think Extinction Rebellion's in over 70 countries now. It's given people a platform on which to stand and stand up for what's right. In terms of actual political wins, I think, you know, change happens in lots of different ways. And even here, people like the police who deal with us, people like the fireys who come to our stalls at the local market. I think in terms of here in Australia and possibly in other countries where we're still small and haven't had that massive impact that they had in London, we're working at that level that people think, okay, there's hope. You know, I think we have a huge mental health effect because people do feel, people can feel very hopeless. And if you think, okay, here's a bunch of people who are actually doing, we say action is the antidote, you know. We are enabling a platform on which people can find a way to speak up for their grandchildren and their children. So in terms of wins, I would say creating a mass civil disobedience movement has probably been the biggest win. And, you know, to me, that's a, not a small thing because the what are the other options, you know? And politicians tell us that privately, you know, a lot of politicians from a particular party who I won't name, you know, come on our actions. 10% of the population of Australia voted Green. You know, if people come along with us, we can really do this. You know, I'm part of the generation. I saw 400,000 people sat down in Bourke Street, Melbourne in 1970, and they shifted government policy. You know, if we could get 400,000 people sitting down somewhere, and there are that many of us out there, all we've got to do is sit down. That's too many people to arrest, but that's enough people to make a big statement to the government.
Indeed. How do you deal with climate change deniers?
I say thanks very much and move on and talk to the next person because I'm not interested in wasting my energy on climate change deniers. You know, they're a tiny fringe. The science is absolutely unequivocal. I just tell them to go and read the science, or I say, what science do you read? Because I read the best science journals in the world. I don't know where you're getting yours from. So I don't really deal with them, to tell you the truth.
I think their science comes from Fox Media.
Well, you know, the fossil fuel industry is like, everybody says it's like the tobacco industry. They've got these, you know, these people that are churning out ridiculous nonsense, and people go to the fringes of the web and find this rubbish and believe it.
What would you say to someone that wants to get involved but is perhaps afraid of getting arrested or maybe the criticism?
I'd say come along to our training in nonviolent direct action. We offer it pretty regularly. We've got one coming up on the 13th of March and one coming up on the 20th of March. We explain there how we approach actions, why we do what we do. We go into a lot of detail about the arrest process that I went through very briefly with you just now. We talk about the kind of fines that we get, you know, what happens in court. We explain to people that a civil disobedience charge, which is usually something like disorderly conduct or disobeying a police officer, doesn't affect you getting a working with children's check. It doesn't affect any part of your job. You know, very respected people from all walks of life have got these charges. You know, I think those of us who've never brushed up against the law before think, oh my God, a criminal charge, it's going to be the end of the world. Lots and lots and lots of people have minor charges, you know, and it's fine to be one of them. It's a badge of honour to be one of them and to use your right to stand up against an unjust system and say, I'm prepared to do this and I'm prepared to risk my reputation. I have one of our members of the movement, their neighbour says, calls them a criminal, and they don't do it in a very joking way. But, you know, it's important to understand the law. It's important to understand how the law works and not to be so terrified by it that you are paralysed as a citizen of a democracy to take the action that's needed, the proportionate action that's needed. So I'd say to those people, get educated, find out the truth. It's not as bad as you think it is. It's not as scary as you think it is. And in Extinction Rebellion, we get arrested with buddies, so we're there with friends, and it's you know, can be quite a positive experience, actually, quite an empowering experience.
How can people reach you? How can they get in contact with Extinction Rebellion to get involved?
Well, obviously we have a pretty big social media presence and we have a web page. And once you sign up on the web page and give your email address, you get newsletters. We try and involve people through local their local area. So in the metro area, we have local groups right across the metropolitan area, so that you're not having to drive miles and miles to go to meetings, and you're meeting up in local cafes with people who know your local area and know your local issues. So that's the easiest thing to do. And then once you do sign up and get involved, you can go to something we call it a welcoming, where we go through the principles and values about the movement. Usually often our first interaction with the public is through our standard talk, which is called Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It. And that goes through the current science of climate change and then talks about the history of civil disobedience and why it works and a bit about Extinction Rebellion. So often people go to one of our Heading for Extinction talks too, and they're well publicised on our website and on our social media pages.
Okay, so I'll make sure we put links of those on our show notes as well.
Oh, thank you. That'd be great.
Not a problem. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners or any other projects that you're currently working on?
I'd like to tell you, listeners, action is the antidote. Don't feel that you can't do anything. You can do something, and there are great people. This is a great social movement with great people in it, supported by great values and principles. I work on the talk, the Heading for Extinction talk personally, and I work on the nonviolent direct action training. We're always looking for people to come and join us in the training team. There are lots of roles out there. Not everybody has to get arrested. For everybody who gets arrested, there are 20 or 30 or 40 people doing other jobs. So that's a very important thing. And you're not going to just come with us on the street and suddenly get snatch arrested. It doesn't happen like that at all. You're aware of what's going on, and if you don't want to get arrested, you step back. You know, our big event is on the 22nd, and that's what we're working towards at the moment, 22nd of March. And we'll be gathering in the centre of Perth. We need numbers. We want you to come. If you care about this issue, just come and be visible, just come and be seen. You don't have to do anything more, you don't have to risk arrest, just come and be visible, find out about a bit about us, and show your face, be willing to stand up for this most existential crisis that we're all facing.
We will certainly be there for the 22nd. We'll be there.
We've both signed up. We've got our training coming ready to be arrested as well. So we should be underway.
I might see you there.
Yep.
Yes, just to get away from the kids for one day would be great if we get arrested.
The 22nd is a nationwide action, so it'll be happening all around the country in all capital cities and lots of provincial cities as well. And it may go on past the 22nd, depending on how much time and energy people have to put into it. Certainly, one of our members is taking 2 days off. I'm taking 2 days off. So we're planning on being on the streets for at least 2 days, 22nd and the 23rd, just to try and make the media presence bigger, just so that people understand more about how very important this issue is.
That's great. So quite often it can be the views of close family and friends that influence people's decisions to get involved or not. On a personal note, has your family been involved in your movement as well? Are they agreeing with your activism?
I think overall my family is so glad I'm there, but they're not there. You know, nobody else in my family is actually involved. And one of my nieces, who has been very aware of the climate crisis for a long while, feels she can't get involved because of her mental health. Like, and, you know, this is a really sad thing that a lot of people can't get too close to this stuff. Certainly once you're in the movement, you do feel the grief. You know, we often sign off our letters to each other with love and rage, but right close there is grief. And I think the thing to do is to realise you can live a life in denial, or you can live a life with friends who support it. The great thing is to be amongst people with Extinction Rebellion. We all know about the grief, and we know about the science, and we don't have to talk about it, but we're there amongst people who feel the same way we do. I went to a family barbecue last night, and, you know, nobody's talking about the climate crisis except, you know, to say, what did you do to today, Heath? Oh, well, I went down to Cottesloe Beach and put my head in the sand. Oh, great. That's really good you're doing that, you know. So, yeah, other people have found their families have actually rejected them. And, you know, I hesitate to say that, but it actually happens. So it can be a hard decision to make to go down this path of civil disobedience and to stand up and be counted for what you believe in.
Understanding the climate emergency, what keeps you up at night?
Oh, you might get me crying here. Well, last year I had two grandchildren, one born in June and one born in August, and then another one born on the 9th of February. So what keeps me up at night is wondering what kind of world those kids are going to have, you know. And I was lucky I grew up in Gosnells. I grew up on the Ellis Brook, this beautiful little brook that runs with full of live things, and, you know, that brook basically doesn't run anymore. What keeps me up at night is thinking, what is there going to be left by 2100 for those grandchildren? You know, they'll be 80 then. Healthcare will have advanced. They'll be 80 years young. But what kind of life will they have? What kind of life will they have? And of all this wonderful richness that we have, especially here in Western Australia, the only biodiversity hotspot in Australia, like just full of life, full of diversity, how much of that is going to go? You know, and that's, I suppose that keeps me up awake at night. It's the grief at the sense of loss. Sorry, I'm going to really bring all your listeners right down here.
No. It is the absolute truth. I mean, we started this whole thing with the podcast because we are so concerned about what the future is for our kids, and we look to them, and we almost, you know, don't get me wrong, we love them all dearly, but we almost look back and think, well, should we have not had kids? Is this an environment to actually bring them into, or a world to bring them into? And it's very hard when you think of, you know, young, we've got a 4, 5 and an 11-year-old, and they're young and they're vibrant and they're energetic and they're looking forward to the future. But we also know that the future is not going to be the same as it is today, and it's not the same today as it was 25 years ago, and so on. And so that is what keeps us up at night as well. So I completely agree with you.
You know, I suppose when you say knowing about the climate emergency, I mean, it's all those tipping points and, you know, the methane burp, and do you read the science or do you not read the science? You know, how much do we really want to know? You know, that recent paper about, what was it, 11 ecosystems collapsing just in Australia. I look at those things and I think, oh, I must read that, but part of me goes, oh, no, not more.
Yeah, the news is often bleak in terms of what we read, in terms of the changes that are happening and likely to happen shortly. So, okay, let me try and turn this around a little bit.
As we
get towards the end, because it is scary. It is also very sad. But there are also things to be optimistic about the future. So what aspects make you optimistic for the future?
Well, you know, I talked earlier about those huge corporations like IKEA and Microsoft, and they're setting realistic targets, 2030, you know. Don't give me 2050. We say 2025. You know, 2030 is not bad. So I think there is a huge groundswell of people and corporations and businesses that are just seeing the writing on the wall. And some of them are acting out of genuine concern for the environment. Some are acting out of, you know, worried about losing their customers or whatever, the hip pocket. But there is a huge amount happening. You know, all across Europe there's electric vehicles, there's green energy, there's wind. Like, the UK is going really big on wind. I talked about living in China, like the size of the wind farms and the solar farms there, they're taking this very seriously. You know, they totally see it happening. So I'm optimistic that there are other countries and other parts of the world that are doing better and that can lead us, that can show us the way. There are people like Ross Garnaut who said, here are all the answers, just do it. You know, so I take optimism from all those people who are still holding out hope and giving solutions and finding ways to make a difference. And, you know, I look at those bright little faces of our kids and our grandkids and I think, well, they give me hope too, because they're our future. I know Greta says, don't look to me for hope, but Greta Thunberg, I mean, I do see hope in those bright faces, and I, you know, I hope that human resilience can take us through this terrible, you know, Roger Hallam calls it a trinity of horror. It's existential, it's universal, and it's exponential. You know, that's the frightening thing, the exponential bit. Sorry, I was supposed to be optimistic.
It's okay.
there is hope. There's reason for optimism.
Yes, there is. There's definitely a lot of companies that are changing, and indeed with the young people walking on the streets now, there's even more reason to change. So
absolutely,
we definitely have to be optimistic about that.
I think a lot of people take optimism from the school strike.
Exactly, I think so. We were there with our little ones, and you can see the passion that there's. Well, with our 11-year-old, you can see the passion behind them, and it's just great to see. Really great to see.
Mm.
And finally, our final question that we ask everyone: if there is one thing that we can change that will have a massive impact on the health of our planet, what would that be? How can we be good?
Obviously, I'm a rebel. I'd say what we have to change is the fact that we've all been too good and we've all been too compliant and we've all believed that the government is going to look after us, and we can't actually get it into our heads that they're not. So, you know, to turn your thing around, I think we've got to be a little bit rebellious and maybe not so good to be good. Yeah. To be good, we've got to be perhaps a little bit not good and just be prepared to do what many of our forebears have done and take a risk and go out there and stand up for our rights as citizens to have a safe future for our kids.
Absolutely. So to be good, we need to be like the rebellious grandma that you are.
Yes, exactly. Join me and lots of other rebellious grandmas and non-grandmas and grandpas out there in the streets. I'd love to see everybody there on March the 22nd.
Yeah,
we will definitely
absolutely.
Be there.
We'll definitely be there. Thank you very much for your time. It's been so awesome to have you here and to listen to your stories and your absolute passion to be rebellious and make a change.
It's been great talking to you. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Not a problem.
Thank you.
Not a problem. Thank you. Take care. So that was quite emotional. I'm not really sure that I wanted to potentially make a guest nearly cry.
It was also emotional for us. I think we've heard too much information and, it's not looking good at the moment.
No. I mean, I think back maybe 10 years ago, and I wasn't really sure about activism, to be honest, then.
Indeed, I actually did not consider it at any point, no, in my life when I was young.
But we're certainly down for it now, and we're going to do what we can. So please help us out and tell your friends to subscribe to this podcast. We rely on your support and word of mouth to keep this thing going.
Thanks again to Heath Greville from Extinction Rebellion. We'll bring you an update on how we get on at the Rebellion. Would be great if you could join us. It's on the 22nd of March. You will be able to find all the details on the Extinction Rebellion website. And just go to your page for your location.
That's great. Hopefully we'll see you there. Take care. Be safe.
Bye.